fortunately for me, my teammates from the Mammoth Track Club or Run USA, like Dina Caster, Ryan Hall, Sarah Hall, and all the people that went by, they would, you know, they would share my mom's homemade bread or Yordanis' homemade bread when we got married, my wife Yordanis, that is. So it's been fun to be able to educate people about that, and they love it. And, you know, sometimes even Ryan Hall and Sarah Hall, they would stop by and she would have, mm-hmm. and then we would bring some. They said, what can we bring? Oh, they said, the mbasha, the bread.
Welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. My name is Claire Shorenstein, and I'm a registered dietitian based in New York City. Today's guest is Meb Kafleski. He hardly needs an introduction, but just in case you're not aware of the many things he has accomplished, he won the 2009 New York City Marathon. He was the first American male to win the Boston Marathon. That was in 2014, the first since 1983. He's won a silver Olympic medal in Athens. That was back in 2004. He's authored several books, which you should definitely check out. They're all wonderful stories of all his various athletic accomplishments and his really interesting background as, you know, having emigrated from Eritrea with his family. And we just had the best time chatting about his nutrition. He, of course, is such a great example of eating for endurance, as I told him so in the beginning of our interview, because he's had this amazing, you know, long career. And I wanted to really deep dive into his nutrition, the ins and outs of what makes him tick and what made him so successful, and of course, what he's enjoying now that he is retired. I hope you enjoy this interview. It truly was a great honor to have him on the show. I was extremely nervous beforehand, but he's such a great guy and such a fun person to talk to. So without further ado, Meb Kafleski.
What constitutes a little run for you, by the way?
8 mile. I like to go about 8 to 9 miles a day, sometimes 7 days a week. Sometimes if the girls have some soccer games or other stuff going on, or I want to sleep in, then I don't plan for it, but it happens. So some kind of, I like to, if I can, continuously run, and it's fun. I don't like to take days off.
Did you take days off when you were professional still, or no?
Nothing. No. Unfortunately, the only days off were the day after a marathon and when I can't walk.
Well, yeah, there you go. Awesome. Well, let's get started officially. Meb, welcome to the Eat for Endurance podcast. It is so exciting to have you on the show today. And of course, we met actually back in the fall. I was extremely pregnant at the time with my second daughter. And you, of course, have 3 daughters. I have 2 now. She's 4 months old now. Handed her off to the sitter when you were initially trying to call me. And it was at Finish Line Physical Therapy at the Alley on the Run show. And I was just so excited to meet you in person finally and talk to you. And the fact that you agreed to be on the show is just really awesome. So thank you for that.
No problem, Claire. Great to see you again. And I'm definitely happy to be on the show. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. You're, of course, such a wonderful example of eating for endurance, which is what this show is all about. And, you know, just longevity in the sport of running. And, you know, you're the oldest marathoner to qualify for the U.S. Olympic team. You, of course, won the Boston Marathon at nearly 39 years old. So really, really looking forward to deep diving into your nutrition today and learning a little bit more about what helped make your career so successful. Nutrition, of course, just being one piece of that whole puzzle. So I usually start these interviews with, you know, an exploration of the athlete's nutrition roots. So, you know, what kinds of foods you grew up with. Of course, you just mentioned a little bit about Eritrean cuisine, which I definitely want to learn more about, and how your diet evolved over time and specifically over the course of your athletic career. And, you know, you have a very unique and wonderful story and a very interesting one. And I think most of my listeners, of course, know who you are, and maybe they do already know that story. For anyone who doesn't, you, of course, emigrated with your family from Eritrea in East Africa at the age of 10. Is that right?
Correct.
To the U.S. via Italy. And, you know, you've written about this and spoke about this many times, so we don't need to go through the whole story. But, you know, you speak of coming from a place of poverty, and I've even heard you say you ate dirt. And What did this look like specifically, like with nutrition? What kinds of foods do you remember eating? You know, if you feel comfortable talking about that, and you know, what does Eritrean cuisine look like? What, you know, I imagine that has stuck with you. Clearly, you're still eating it, so maybe you can kind of just give us a little picture about your nutrition roots.
I would love to. And first, full disclosure, I wish I could get all the credit for nutrition, but I must do credit before I forget off the bat for my mom, my sisters, and especially my wife for my professional career, because I might run the endurance or the distance and whatnot, but they're behind the scenes who make things happen from my childhood all the way to who I am now. Growing up in Eritrea was difficult because of the war, the civil war for independence against Ethiopia. That lasted for 31 years. So really, I mean, kecha is bread that is kind of hard that we eat for breakfast with tea usually. And then for lunch and dinner, it's probably the same thing. It's called the fibentin in Ethiopian cuisine or Eritrean cuisine. Taita, which is the bread and stew like lentils. And if you are fortunate enough to have chicken or cows or sheep or whatnot, or somebody guests come visit the family, then you will have a delicacy of meat. But meat is usually reserved for higher or special occasions. So churro or lentils is what is kind of custom day to day for lunch and dinner. Most of it is organic. I think been having a farm where we have to plant our own grain, where we have to plant our own corn. All that stuff, or lettuce, tomato, potatoes, and jalapenos, tomatoes, all those things were always, you come in your hand, come from the farm to your house. So I know now in the U.S. sometimes it's like that from farm to table restaurants and things like that, which in San Diego I have enjoyed eating that during my professional career when we go out. But at the same time, I mean, there's no electricity, no running water in Eritrea. So everything is, you know, if you want to grind to make it a flour. I remember my mom just using a brick and a flat rock, and that is made to be able to just grind, you know, from grain to flour. I mean, that's how raw, how organic everything was. And a lot of labor, a lot of, I guess you could call it TLC. Standard love and care. So you can see, like, hambasha is what I'm known for. To have before my races, but that was also a normal thing at our house in Eritrea and Italy when we came to the United States. Hambasha is the closest you could assemble is to Hawaiian bread, very soft, fluffy, and very, very, very sweet. So I really enjoy that. I would put almond butter or honey or peanut butter in it, but it's always available. You know, you put it in a Ziploc bag. I mean, fortunately for me, my teammates from the Mammoth Truck Club or Run USA, like Dina Caster, Ryan Hall, Sarah Hall, and all the people that went by, they would, you know, they would share my mom's homemade bread or Yordanis' homemade bread when we got married, my wife Yordanis, that is. So it's been fun to be able to educate people about that, and they love it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, even Ryan Hall and Sarah Hall, they would stop by and we'll have them at our house, and they would come to our house, have their house, or Dina would have a special occasion. Dina is a wonderful cook, and she would have, and then we would bring some. They say, what can we bring? Oh, they said the hambasha, the bread. So it's delicious. Been a fun way to. But in Eritrea, like I said, it was just from farm to your house, very organic, and everything that you bring to your house is manually done, and no expiration date, and whether it's eggs is very traditional there, and you have your hens or chicken in your backyard, so that's, you know, the meat and the eggs there for you. So that's how. But at the same time, we were poor, we didn't have a lot, and I remember eating dirt, just kind of go to the moisture of the dirt and dig until you feel like it's soft enough, and something in your brain that kind of tells you to look for it, or you might heard about soldiers doing it and things like that. So that was survival at its best, but sometimes some of the delicious, because the crops were organic, so it's it's 100% organic.
What was that transition like going, you know, to Italy? You spent some time in Italy and then to the U.S. You know, that must have been quite, you know, culture shock there. And certainly in terms of cuisine, did your diet change a lot when you were making these big changes and big moves to these new countries?
Yeah, I mean, it did change a lot. You know, I remember first time we had probably apples, you know, it was a green apple or sour. Many people know that I love fruits, and Meb for Mortals, my book, I talk all that stuff, how what they like Meb. But I remember first time I had an apple, I said, ew, this is nasty and whatnot, because it was so sour, you know, and so that was different. And I think, you know, the Italian have some kind of, Eritrea was colonized by Italy, so we had the pasta, the rice, it was a little bit of, not as big of transition. but you know, we love having lasagna for the first time. You know, we didn't go out. I'm thankful for my parents because one, financially was not conducive, and two, they always made meals at home. So it was from fresh, you know, on Wednesdays, it's called Mercato, which means a store or open store on the streets. And my mom and dad usually used to go to that and pick up the vegetables, the fruits, the onions, and all those things from the street of, I guess, farmer's market is what they call in the U.S. But we remember doing that in Italy. And as much as we can't host in the United States, we are down as used to do that. Whenever we can see a fresh thing, it's kind of bringing back to our roots to be able to, you know, be as organic as possible. But yeah, I mean, it was different. Like pizza was not your typical thing, or hamburger or fries. You kind of try a little by little, and then it's like sometimes you like things and other things you don't. You know, I remember like thing in a hamburger, you put the sauce, the yellow sauce, it was very spicy and I didn't like it.
Mustard.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, no way. Yeah. There's no way I can do that. You know, so sometimes you love it. Something you like, you know, I mean, actually ice cream. We never had one in Eritrea. And then you're like, oh, gelato, ice cream, you know, that's your roots of Italy. So whenever I see gelato, I'm always for it. I never pass that one forward. I never pass that one as a dessert.
Was that just like mind blowing, like trying gelato for the first time? I imagine that must have just been like amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. It was mind blowing. And it's like, oh, where was this been hiding? But it's the same thing with TV. Though. But, you know, I was always in shock, though, because I was 10 years old when I left Eritrea, when we lived in Italy. First time I saw TV. So I'm like, how did those people fit in there? So that was a mind blown in its own, because I'm like, how is that possible? How did they fit in? I went back behind the screen to see if they were there. So the good and bad, delicious food like gelato or the Italian food is always amazing. And but also a shock to the mind when you see a TV for the first time or remote control things. And it's like, how is that working? And I have to kind of try to learn expedite.
Did it mess with your stomach at all, like making all these dietary changes as you, you know, went to the U.S. and just, you know, got introduced to all these, especially like any kind of packaged or processed foods, kind of going from the way you were eating before?
I mean, it still does sometimes for me, because I thank God for my wife, Yordanos, and we try to eat as much as we can at home. But when we eat greasy stuff, and sometimes when you're traveling, and we're so used to home-cooked meals, and when we travel, sometimes that still does. But yeah, when we were getting prepared, we didn't know what it was, obviously. but whenever it's got some grease, and then it's definitely harder to adapt to the stomach. But, you know, I guess my stomach was pretty strong from eating dirt and things like that.
So yeah.
I can't
eat that. Awesome. Yeah.
It's becoming more tighter and tighter.
So your mother was cooking for all of you, and you were all eating together. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We ate as ma'adi, which is an Eritrean word that we eat together from the same plate. So especially with the traditional food, you have a big platter of tortilla. Imagine a humongous tortilla. That's what the injera looks like. And then you have a stew of spices like siga, which means meat, or you can have lentil, you can have vegetables, a lot of colors and in different patches. But the main course would be in the middle, like this stew, and around it would be the salad, the cabbage, the lentils and things like that. And everybody wash their hand. It's a tradition, the youngest makes everybody wash their hand, and you have a clean hand. But and then you dive in like burrito, you know, just eat as much as you can. And Eritrean show their respect or welcoming by presenting food. So you have to, it's an insult if you go to some Eritrean food and you don't eat their food. So, but now we always ate together at dinner, mainly because school was kind of on the way, and breakfast was not together, you know, each for its own. And then, but dinner, my parents always made time for us. And sometimes they do pasta, Italian. We never really got to hamburger and barbecue, things like that when we grow up. But a lot more healthier food and family-oriented, like, you know, the pasta with the big, my dad would make sometimes a big sauce of pasta, I mean, pasta sauce. And then we would have a spaghetti or short pasta and back ravioli, and then also with salad and things like that.
And I know spaghetti and meatballs is like one of your pre-race rituals for a very long time, right? So that kind of stemmed, I mean, it's obviously a very standard thing to have, but perhaps it also, you know, stemmed from in part your time in Italy and your love for pasta as well, or where did that come from?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't remember too much having pasta in Eritrea, but a lot more traditional. But when we went to Italy, it was the welcoming thing of is the pasta, spaghetti with meatball, and my mom made it, and my sisters made it, and eventually whenever I went to Mammoth Lakes to train or within driving distance, my mom would give me loads. You know, remember the ice cream gallon? That comes with in a gallon size, and mm-hmm. we would after the ice cream was done, my mom would freeze the pasta sauce there. And when I went to Mammoth Lakes, I was traveling or training camp, and she would give me that sauce, and I would make it for when I was training camp. So I always went with sauce, always whenever I traveled. And eventually, my wife also adapted to that, and then she helped me make that. And so it's something that I look forward to, and especially before my tempo run, which means race pace or intervals, hard sessions, and then on hard days, I would go into a protein diet, like chicken, beef, or fish, but mainly a lot of during the day, omelette with avocado or turkey, and you know, a lot of greens, whether it's green pepper, avocado, and things like that. But yeah, the pasta, you know, whenever I travel, that's my go-to before races, because I know it works for me, and I always stuck with it. And then even when we travel, it was a UCLA or other races, I try to have that. But and then there's others that you cannot always find it in VR, and Tokyo for the Chiba Ekiden and things like that. So you have to resort to rice and chicken. And, and my mom also, whenever I am in the States, she always sends me with the homemade bread, and eventually my wife ended up doing that as well.
Awesome. Well, how lucky are you to have such wonderful women cooking such awesome stuff for you? That's great. So let's talk about how you kind of got into running. And of course, you grew up loving and playing soccer and essentially fell into running when a high school coach discovered your talent. And, you know, as you began to train more and more and become more competitive during high school, and especially, you know, when running for UCLA, your nutrition, I imagine, changed. And maybe it was just that you ate more. Maybe it didn't change that much. But, you know, maybe you can speak a little bit about how your nutrition started to evolve before you went pro. You know, kind of were you using sports nutrition products at the time, or any kind of nutrition rituals you started to create for yourself other than the spaghetti and meatballs, of course. But yeah, talk to us a little bit about what nutrition looked like for you as you started to become competitive before you went pro.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when my running was discovered in seventh grade, Coach Dick Lord, and then eventually to my high school, Ed Ramos, and, you know, they always tell you to eat right, but, you know, fortunately for me, like I said earlier, my parents always made it the right food for us, though the house was never without fruits. We always had fruits on the top of the kitchen, middle of the kitchen table or on the counter, so I try to emulate that as much as I can now. And because when you have healthy diet, you will grab what is in front of you. And, you know, as you alluded to, when I was at UCLA, I remember, I think I was a end of my sophomore year, exercise physiology 5 is the class I took. And I can't take the professor's name right now, but he was a weightlifter guy. and he says, write everything down you eat and what kind of exercise you do. And, you know, growing up poor in Eritrea, and I was eating, I mean, I was running a lot of miles. My metabolism was at its peak probably. And so I could eat anything, everything, get away with it. And as I was running, you know, my weight was always, I took, you know, not control, but I tried to see what I'm monitoring. But that day, he says, you know, I wrote out everything that he says, you are lucky, you have good genetic and you run, otherwise you would be obese, because what I was eating was, you know, I would have the Italian pasta, I would have pizza, I would have chicken, I would have desserts and just for dinner. And then lunch, I would do the same thing. I would have turkey sandwich, I would have pasta and whatnot. And for breakfast, I would also have like French toast, pancakes, the dorm. Eat as much as you want. Yeah. I was making up for the time lost. So, he says, well, you know, I'm not saying don't have any of those. I just said, just have one of them. Instead of like five choices that you have, just choose one. And drastically, my run performance increased to better. I mean, I was lighter, I was stronger, mm-hmm. I was more energetic. So I started packing my lunch. Instead of coming back to the dorms, I would take a turkey sandwich and a banana or an apple. And then, you know, I would stay on campus instead of coming back to the dorms and eat. So that helped. And then obviously probably did my more training also and started implementing morning runs. And, mm-hmm. you know, the running took off. And then that's when I thought maybe, oh, the Olympics is a possibility. But before that, it never crossed my mind. It did other people, including mm-hmm. my seventh grade teacher, Duke Lord, or my classmates in high school, or Ron Tapp, or Ed Ramos, or others who believed in me. But that was pretty evident for me when I won four NCAA title 1 year, 97. Then it's like, oh, I think I could do this. So I have to take my job seriously as a student athlete and monitor what I ate and be careful. And you are what you put in your system. I learned that right away, and I start adapting, and the rest is history. And more as I, you know, I think that's one of the longevity that I had is to monitor what I ate and weigh myself. And I know what works for me. I mm-hmm. indulge, and I have off season, but during the season, I'm on a very, very strict diet.
Yeah. And at what point in your college career did you take that nutrition course that you mentioned?
A sophomore year, I believe. My best year was when I was a junior, so I'm pretty sure it was a sophomore year.
Got it. And when you were a freshman, did you gain the freshman 15?
I'm pretty sure I did, but thank God for running. I think it gave me neutral.
I'm sure you were using all of those calories that you met, you know, that you're eating. I mean, it sounds like you were working pretty hard there. Okay, so let's talk about some, you know, significant nutrition learning moments throughout your professional career and how these experiences change your approach. You know, obviously there are things that we can control. You know, we talk about maintaining this strict diet and weighing yourself, all this stuff, training with specific foods or products. That's, of course, one thing I always think about when, you know, practicing and controlling things. But obviously there are others that we can't, you know, for instance, getting food poisoning or getting sick in other ways. I know in 26 Marathons, your latest book, you talked about getting food poisoning a few days before the marathon in 2006. Or, of course, there's the experience of the Summer Olympics 2016 when you had stomach issues during the race. Those are, of course, learning opportunities. And maybe you can share a little bit about how you've handled those times where, you know, things happen that you can't control that aren't somewhat nutrition or diet related and what you kind of took away from that.
You know, what you can control is getting to the starting line as healthy, as strong as possible. But, you know, when you're at a restaurant, you can't control what you're going to be served and or what you're going to encounter during a race. So, yeah, I mean, I had those incidents in 2006 of food poisoning. And, I mean, I thought that was the year for me to win. I've been second place in New York in 2004, third in 2005. I'm like, this is it. And then Thursday before the race, I encountered food poisoning. I'm like, really? How is this possible? But I still, yeah. You know, and some people say don't run the race, but I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot, do the best that I can because I've been working really hard. But I went with the leaders and then struggled to the finish line. But you do what you can control. And I think, you know, sometimes it allow you to think twice again, or as you said, it give you a learning experience, you know, and you can do everything right. And then on the last minute, the chips don't fall like they should. And you kind of get disappointed, but it's not the end of the world. You can, you know, for that moment, it seems like devastating and it's a disappointment, but you could always bounce back. And, you know, as they say, it's not how many times you fall, but how many times you get back up. And that's the same mm-hmm. example that I had in Rio Olympics. I mean, here I am. When I made the Olympic team, I was excited. You know, I was joking around with my wife, say, hey, I'm just going to go to Rio, party it up. I'm going to be 50 pounds overweight. And, you know, we're going to do all the things, you know. But
yeah, right.
The competitive guy that I was, I'm like, hey, girls, you know, I wanted to make sure my daughters have the memories. And so I'm like, you know, I didn't show up until the last minute. And then, you know, they set at altitude, my comfort zone, and, you know, just train really hard. And you think you're going to have a chance for a medal. But then the race goes off. You stay back, just play smart. And then you go into the halfway point. You think, hey, this is perfect. Working out perfectly the way I want it, you know. And you're in the mix of the group. And then 2 minutes later, everything changes. I wanted to throw up. And I'm like, oh my goodness, why is this happening now? I just felt I can medal, it's playing in my head, and then now it's going switched, but I stopped and tried to throw up and couldn't, and just, I think it was hit hive and just kept going. And I said, you know what, don't get disappointed, be in the moment, try to close the gap, don't give up. And then, you know, go 2 miles, okay, and then it happens again. So I really stopped like 7 times. And then as I come to the finish line, this is my last Olympic, and I wanted to celebrate in the best way I can. And I know I can't catch the guy in front of me. I didn't even know what place I was in. And I know the guy behind me was far enough. So I'm like, well, I'm going to tip my hat to Joan Bonnoy, the first woman who won the gold medal, and just as she salute. And next thing I know, I was on my knees and chest hit the ground. I'm like, I always wanted to be a gymnast, but not in front of a TV, you know? And I just hammered really bad. But then I thought about the people that were in the crowd. They're like, it was just dead quiet. They're like, ooh. And I'm like, I got to let them know, okay. I'm okay. And now they're like, oh, I'm going to do 3 push-ups with my daughters. I'm like, 1, 2, 3. And everybody just went really energetic, clap, you know, and that. And then, you know.
No, I remember watching that. You said it was more of like a heat issue. Did you train kind of anticipating the weather there? Or
I did. Like, did you make preparations? I sat in the sauna for like 35, 40 minutes, you know. And
wow.
In the whatever 100-some degree, but you know, sometimes, you know, nutrition can play a role. But I know that was not a nutrition day for me. You know, I remember even, you know, because skepticism of a new place. I remember Amy, Craig, and Shalane were staying in the same hotel that I was staying. So like, you know, the ladies went first. I'm like, hey, where'd you guys eat? What did you dress and this and that? So I just did what they did. And I know it was not a nutrition issue. It was just more of a heat, humidity. And yeah, I train in, you know, with sweats on, just like I did for Athens, whatever I did for Athens. So I do that. But in Athens, I had the age on my side. And
yes. Yeah, that was quite a few years earlier.
It's important. You know, I've been very fortunate to learn as I get advice. I've been very fortunate to have Generation You Can, who's been my game changer, that helped me since 2009 to get the performance that I needed. And, you know, you have those moments to say, hey, getting to Sunline is healthy. But, you know, I might have had the 2016 episode, but since 2009, I've never had any other issues. So it's great to count on a product and a partnership like that to help you go through your endurance performance to the best that you can. And, you know, sponsors always demand the best of you, and you in training try to do the best you can, because you know your family's counting on you, your sponsors counting on you, the race organizations count on you. So you do what you can to be ready, and then the other stuff is out of your control. But you can control getting the starting line as healthy and as strong as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned You Can, so let's talk about your nutrition sponsorships for a second, since we're on the topic. So you have a very special relationship with You Can, you know, starting in 2009, as you mentioned, and that was pretty much when the company started up, right? You were pretty much with them from the get-go, and you know, you've played a really integral role in basically this company existing and being so successful. And you mentioned, of course, you know, it being a game changer for your fueling and recovery needs. So yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit more about why you love their products and, you know, why it's worked for you, how you use it. Yeah. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I think 2009 was the migration to You Can, and it started with a rare disease Jonah Fettelman had, and his mom, Wendy, and Dave used to wake Jonah up in the middle of the night to feed him so he can have glycogen storage. And I think the superstarch kind of worked for them by accident to make him live longer and make sure they don't, you know, he doesn't pass away, basically. And so that's how it started, and Jonah and I became good friends and the family. And it was 2009 that started this relationship. I was the first athlete they signed, and they never thought it would be. Before that, it was never for athlete; it was more survival. Mm-hmm. But what it had in there, the superstarch, was amazing, and they eventually have protein in it to be able to have consistent energy. And I fell in love with it because I do a lot of traveling and to be lean and as much as I can to replenish my body for the next moment to recover. So whenever I am training, when I was Mammoth Lakes and go to Bisha, which is 40 miles, Mammoth Lakes is 8,000 feet high and Bisha 4,100 feet. So if I'm going to do to get speed workout there, that's a long way. So when I come back, I need to have that energy for a couple of hours when I get back to ICE or to go to the gym or get a physical therapy. So I started implementing that and fell in love with the product. And, you know, I think it has served me as a game changer for me. And to just to give you what you need, consistent energy, not crashing. And also, it's a product that I really believe in. And, you know, I tried it, obviously, before I endorsed it and fell in love with it. And the story behind it, what the story is, and it's been big. I still use it now to this day, and as much as
awesome. And so what does that look like in your embraces? You know, like, you of course have your bottles pre-made, ready to go, that you're grabbing, that hopefully you don't miss grabbing, although I'm sure that's happened before. Actually, has that happened before, where you've missed your bottle?
It happened at the 2012 Olympics.
oh gosh, so, like, what do you even do in that situation? Like, does someone like chase after you, or do you grab it somewhere else? Like, what happens?
To be honest, that time, I remember I was the team manager there, and he just says, he just threw it at me, catch. I was like a football, you know, player and quarterback, and I was a wide receiver, and obviously I didn't catch it, but.
So you just kind of hang in until the next opportunity? Throw, you know? Do you just hang in there until the next healing opportunity?
Eventually shared with Ryan, had his drink, so they miscommunicated with Ryan Hall and myself. I got his, and he didn't grab mine, and then I waited for him to give his, and then after that we shared. But at the same time, we have what we used to in practice, so in practicality that you want to be able to just use what you've been used to, and unfortunately I couldn't for that moment, and had trouble eventually, but because it was hot and humid also in London. But at the same time, you can't go back. And sometimes I have gone back, you know, if it's just, but then when you have, especially when it happened at the first 5K, it's just too overcrowded. You're going to tremble or pull a hamstring and things like that. So might as well go. But I loved it when I was at table 3 or 4, but as a defending champion in the New York and Boston, it was a little bit, because sometimes you're in the zone, you didn't see the table, you know, you have signs that fluid in 150 meters or 200 meters.
Yeah.
You missed that sign. And you know, I was table 1 at the defending champion those 2 years. And I'm like, if I miss it, I miss it. You know, you're trying to go. But if you are somewhere in the middle, people are going to the right or to the left, you know, there's something's going on. So you have time to react. But been table 1, it's not, you don't have time to react.
Yeah, no, that must be pretty tough. Of course, you're not out there for hours and hours. Like, you're out there for 2 and change, so it's a little bit different. But it's still crucial, obviously, that you're getting your nutrition in. So I've always been curious about that with elites, you know, what happens when you miss your bottle. In terms of UCAN, I was going to ask, you know, in the race, so you have your pre-mixed drinks, like, are you aiming for a certain number of calories per hour? Like, what is your kind of general strategy for marathons when you're racing them?
Well, as you alluded to, when, you know, I usually have about 10 ounce, 8 ounce of fluid, electrolyte in there. And I try to take as much as I can. Depends on the weather. But if you miss it, it's not the end of the world, obviously. And because, you know, you'd rather just have some and put on in your mouth and get away your chicks. And the sugar will tell the brain that you got something and you can put it out. But the more you can take, the better, because it's not at the moment that you're feeling, but down the road, 2-3 miles in the run, that when you get 2-3 down the road, you might say, oh, I wish I'd taken it. So you always want to maybe 200, maybe sometimes 300 meters, just because my competitor will make a move. And when you're drinking and you get distracted, it's not going down as easily. So you want to hold on, carry it, and then till everybody settle down and then drink it. But I think it's very important to take it as much as you can.
Yeah. Now, one of your other sponsors, I'm not sure if this is a current one, but Power Bar, are you still working with them? Or was that a former?
But I was past.
So you used to. And you were with Power Bar at the same time as UCAN, or was that at separate times?
I was actually with Power Bar at the same time. UCAN did not have bars yet, so I used fluid, and then I used bars. And you know, in the past, I have used the gels, things like that.
Okay. Yeah, just because that's a very different type of product, obviously. That's a much more kind of standard carbohydrate, you know, quickly digested. And so I was just a little curious about how you use something like that compared to like a UCAN product.
You know, for me, it's very important to have carbohydrate. And then, you know, before UCAN, I think when I was at UCLA, we used Power Bar. So I had history with them. when UConn came, and you know, I didn't have bars. So I used the power bars, not the drinks. But when UConn came with the drink and power and the bars, and I stuck with them.
Yeah. Aside from the UConn products and of course Smart Training, you know, any other keys to recovery that you'd like to share? I know it's just one piece of the puzzle, but you know, what other any other nutrition aspects that you felt were really important to your recovery?
Well, I think fruits are important, like blueberries for anti-inflammatory is very mm-hmm. important. And antioxidant, obviously, so you don't get sick. Yep. But I think for me, I like to have eggs. So mm-hmm. I'm not the person that have a big meal before I go for a run, but I'll have a toast and a tea. Or if I have hard days, I'll do coffee. But then when you come back, you know, the greener the plate, the better. And mm-hmm. for me, I have to have some, you know, omelets is a good way to go. And avocado and green pepper has a lot of vitamin C. And uh-huh. And obviously, the UConn is the first thing that goes to my system after a hard, intense workout. So, you know, I use it mm-hmm. while I exercise, but afterward it's the first thing that I go that gets me home. And I get home, I eat a real meal. And then I eat two meals a day, big ones, lunch after my run, and then dinner. Mm-hmm. But snacks a lot in between. And as we get older, I would emphasize more protein in before, mm-hmm. you know, or as before you can have bread and things like that. But as I got older, mm-hmm. a lot of nuts. I think, you know, don't go until you get hungry, just graze throughout the day and keep your energy level high.
Awesome. And you have said in other interviews you were maintaining kind of a strict diet while training. And as you mentioned earlier, you weighed yourself daily. You had a racing weight, you knew that worked for you. And I read that one change you made was, you know, a reduction in simple carbohydrates and an increase in proteins. You mentioned increase your proteins just now. Yeah. Can you discuss that a little bit more and kind of where you got that from? I don't know if I assume you must, as an elite, you have like a team that includes a nutritionist or whatnot, but yeah, maybe you can kind of discuss a little bit more your reasoning behind that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, weight is important, but it's only important to know what your past is. And for me, mm-hmm. you know, as a 5K, 10K, I was okay in college and high school, whatever weight I was, but for a marathon, I got to carry it for 26.2 miles. So you want to be mm-hmm. diligent of what works for each individually. I'm not saying men or women, you shouldn't starve yourself or whatnot, but figure out what works for you on a tempo run or intervals and things like that. And say, hey, I felt great that way, then stick to that. And what I've done is, as now I got older, my weight was not, you know, it's not going down. So what I have to do is change my diet and try to avoid, in fact, sugar. You know, I love tea. I love to have a tea or coffee in the morning, mainly tea in the mornings, unless I have a hard day. And I would eliminate completely the sugar part of it, just because if I want to lose weight, I want to do that. But mm-hmm. when I'm off season, I indulge myself with as much sugar as possible.
I hear you have quite the sweet tooth.
I do have the sweet tooth. So when you study with that, I think, you know, my wife and I kind of work a lot on this, you know, because she helped me with the nutrition aspect of it. And, I would, you know, when we go out, sometimes we do go out to restaurants. And I would just, you know, especially when I'm by myself, train if I'm in a train, I'm by myself, instead of cooking, I would go to a restaurant and I would cut in half. The proportion in the United States is big, you know, and I would mm-hmm. cut in half. And whereas before, when I was 19 or 25, I can eat the whole thing and get away with it because I was more active and my metabolism was pretty quick. And now that has changed. I was at 33, or I think it was probably 34 or 33 when that everything just like I gotta stop doing this. And but there have been other times when I was in London, you know, getting ready for the London Marathon. We went to a Thai place. I don't eat spice past Thursday or so before Sunday mm-hmm. race, but I ordered something and it was not enough. And I have to say, can you give me another order? She's like, you're going to have to pay for it. I said, no problem. You know, but, you know, so those things that you have to work for you, because running a marathon or half marathon, you're demanding a lot of your body. So you have to replenish your body to make sure it's a go. And, you know, so you have to, you know, adapt what it needs to be done to help you, you know, go to the distance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I imagine you must be so in tune with your body and what works for you and knowing what works. And, you know, kind of as we talked about before, obviously there's some things out of our control, but when we are doing the things that we can control and our body's working with us and, you know, you're feeling good, you know, you are eating when you're hungry and able to honor that. And of course, as you're mentioning, like sometimes you're cutting portions in half, you are weighing yourself, you're monitoring things very, very closely, because obviously every second and millisecond counts when you're an elite marathoner. It's not just, you know, oh, you know, this pound here, that's pound there. It does matter. But of course, as you're older, your appetite changes, your metabolism changes, all these things, but you're still running all these miles. So I bet you must have been, you know, you're hungry, like going from, I mean, I think all of us can relate to training, like starting a training cycle and just our appetite skyrocketing and adjusting to that and kind of, you know, starting to deal with that. So, I mean, does that happen to you too, where you're just like starting a big training cycle and you just feel your appetite just, you know, increase so much and you're ravenous all the time? Does that happen at all? Is it hard to kind of control your intake? Do you feel like you're meeting your needs in that regard?
It's all about setting goals. Your appetite is going to go up when you start exercising. Like I said, sometimes for 27 years of my life has been all about the strides, millisecond, second that counts, to see how many strides I can beat that person or trying to catch up that person or fight for each spot. And, you know, in fact, this morning I was telling my wife, we were crossing the road in Florida, and I said, I've done enough running. We sprinted in front of the cars trying to, you know, before the car comes. I'm like, I've done enough running, you know, take it easy, you know. But so, and she said, you got a point, you know. But at the same time, every season is different for everybody, you know. He said, hey, I want to be able to start a 5K. Or for somebody like me, it's like, okay, I want to come back and see if I can run half marathon at this pace or full marathon at this pace. But you have to adapt to the new things. But yeah, when you do new exercise, you get sore. You know, but also when you're exercising, your appetite is going to open up. But fortunately for me, since I've been exercising for 30 years now, it's been always open. You know, it's going to be like, yeah, I got to monitor. I became efficient. So I don't have the people say, hey, I ran 5 miles and I never done this before. Now my appetite is higher or I feel exhausted. I need to replenish. But for me, because I'm so efficient, I can go for hours without, you know, probably needing a fruit or whatever, because when I run 5 miles, I might not burn as much as somebody else who just getting started, you know, and that's the difference. Because, and it's, you know, sometimes it's not fair because 5 miles is 5 miles.
yeah, of
and
course.
Like, my wife asks me sometimes, you know, what was that? I'm like, well, I ran 10 miles, how many did you burn? I'm like, I ran like 650 or 600 calories. That's like 2 bananas or something, you know, I took around with, you know, but yeah, that's the cost of being efficient. And sure. I'm not a big guy by any means either. So it's kind of like, you gotta do what you can to be healthy for you individually. You know, everybody's different and age and gender. So say, hey, for me, I want to set a goal, and, you know, when the appetite opens up, eat salads. That's what I used to do, and I used to drink a lot more water before I ate meals to help me shed the weight that I was looking for. But it doesn't mean ignore the real meal. It just means you got to play a little trick on your mind, on your body. Yeah. So, but, you know, at the same time, what you eat, what you put in your system, you need energy. You need food to have the energy, and especially when you are running anywhere outside, whether it's 3 miles or a full marathon, your body demands energy and you want to put a good one into it.
Yeah. And it sounds like there was a bit of a balancing act between, obviously, you needed to feed your body and support all of the work that you were doing, and you were doing a lot of it. And then, of course, you know, controlling and closely monitoring, which, you know, most of us, obviously, we're not, you know, we're running to win, which is, I know, your big motto, but not to actually win. And you're running to actually win. And so we, you know, you obviously need to be a lot stricter than most of us do. And did your nutrition strategy change based on whether you're home in San Diego or training at altitude or traveling, or were you able to kind of keep it pretty consistent?
Some changes, because at altitude, you consume a lot more, you're more leaner, just because internally you're working. But not a huge difference, but I think you have to adapt to, especially with humidity, and you might need more salt, you know, mm-hmm. at altitude, you know, you probably want to eat more frequent than you would at sea level, because whether you're hiking or walking or whatever, you are 8,000 feet and your body is working. So those where you have to, you know, obviously my wife and kids and myself, we would come to sea level and we had all the energy in the world, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, you know, the girls always had an appetite. We're like, you know, those girls can eat. We're like, that's a great thing, you know, and we just feed mm-hmm. them as much healthy as possible. But when at sea level, they probably don't eat as much as they like, but they still got the energy for a long time.
Yeah. So let's talk about your girls for a minute and your family. Obviously, you know, having a family and having all those demands of being a professional athlete, that can be very challenging. How old are your daughters now?
My daughters are going to be 14 in March and 12 in March, and the youngest just turned 10 last month.
Wow. And of course, you know, you are famous as being a runner, but you're also a father and a husband, and your girls were born while you were, you know, a professional athlete and doing all these things. And I imagine that was quite tough for you, although I know your wife, you know, was very supportive in that regard. But yeah, how did getting married and having young kids kind of play into your nutrition and training and all the demands of recovery and throughout your racing career? I imagine you were eating a little bit differently than the rest of the family. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, people often ask me, did you see yourself as an Olympian or world class athlete and things like that? No, but I envision myself as a family man, the best that I can, and being married and have kids early on in my life. And to be an athlete and to have my kids, it was a blessing for me, just because that's what I envisioned myself. And it was a lot of fun. When I get some envious, I guess, when you see people riding Mission Bay Park and they're feeding the birds or they're riding their bikes. I'm like, oh, I want to do that with my kids down the road and things like that. So I love, you know, for a long time, we used to do a lot of picnics, you know, with the girls. We would go, they love it. I mean, we would go to the Mammoth Park, or we'd get a Subway sandwich, or we'd make our own sandwich, or just hang out. And I think it's important to teach them. You know, they didn't know what a donut was when our oldest was like 6 year old or 7 year old. She's like, what is the donut? We're in the middle of the aisle of the store with the donuts. She never knew what donuts were. So we, not intentionally, but at the same time, we're taught them what to eat healthy as much as we can.
Yeah.
And my wife did a great job in terms of home cooked and then also good meals for, you know, for them. And sometimes when the kids were, she would do three different meals. You know, she would do for the youngest one. They never ate jar food, thanks to my wife. She always, you know, so yeah, so it was as organic as it can get and as much healthy as it can. And then for me as an athlete, she, whatever my demand was, whether it was a protein day and they had needed something else, they want to do macaroni and cheese, she'd do the macaroni and cheese for them, and she would do from scratch, that is, and then also do protein for me, and sometimes she has to do something for herself because she's not a meat person as much. So yeah, I mean, and you know, obviously when we're at my high peak, even my birthday comes in May, and it's kind of in the middle of the season sometimes, and we wouldn't have the cake that traditional parents would have for their birthdays, and we'd have fruit cake, you know, and stuff like that. So they've been very disciplined. They were very supportive of what I did. And now I try to enjoy as much as smoothies or ice cream and cookies and with them, you know. But I always tell them when I travel or when I'm in train camp, then spoil yourself, you know. But I don't, because for me, if I see it, I have to have it. So if you guys can hide it somewhere, I'm good. As long as I don't see it, I'm good. You know, I'm training and you cook something.
Yeah.
But if I see it, then I'm like, oh, one cookie was not going to hurt me. As you know, I have a sweet tooth, and then I have this one hurt me. And then, you know, and then it will show in the pounds.
So were you ever stealing little bites of their mac and cheese or no?
You know, I do now. And I was not introduced to mac and cheese. I didn't have it growing up, so it wasn't
delicious.
For me.
It's something
that I know it's delicious, but I didn't know what I was missing out yet.
Yeah. So you're retired, of course, now, and I imagine life looks quite different. Are your girls really excited that you're retired and you can kind of be with them more? You mentioned you took them to school today, and life must, I mean, you're still busy. You're still traveling, making appearances, lots of stuff, but it sounds like you're just there with them a bit more, and it must be a nice change.
When I'm at home, I'm with them all the time. That's my goal here. And, you know, some people, I don't tweet about it, I don't write about it, but at the same time, that's the privacy between me and the kids. But I love, when I'm home, I take them to school. And one of them, today I walked, she's about a little over half mile. I walked with her. And then the next one, she had a special program session. It was school, early school. I dropped her off and then came back and picked my other daughter to the same school. But, you know, I enjoy it. And then, you know, time with my wife, whether it's go biking or go run. And we start together, but we finish at a different time and we enjoy each other. So, yeah, I try to be as much as I can when I'm here. But to your point, though, I do travel a lot, at least the next February, March and April is going to be very grueling for me. But then I take 3 months off with them, like I did last summer. I took the whole summer off and I didn't show and didn't go anywhere. But we drove from San Diego to Tampa. I think it was about a week. We did a lot of activities and things like that. But I was here the whole time with them, too. So, my goal was to, when I have kids, as much work my butt off, and hopefully I can spend time with them, and I try to do as much as I can.
Do they run with you, or do they do any other sports or anything like
that? You know, they're into soccer, so mom and dad are soccer parents are full swing right now. And sometimes we go to different places. Yesterday was Fiori, our middle child, soccer game, and then I went to Savannah, Georgia just a week ago with me and the oldest one, Sara, and with her team. So, you know, I'm trying to spend as much as I can one-on-one as well. But at the same time, where Fiori is the one that Fiori, the middle one, is kind of interested in doing half marathon. She's considered doing the
Crossbrella.
She's like, why don't you do the 8K, the 5K or 15K? She's like, no, I want to do the half marathon.
So of course.
Hopefully hope she keeps it up, because that would be something that, I mean, I would love somebody, one of them to run if that's for fun. I mean, if they can want to compete, great. If they don't, then it's that run to win philosophy, you know, do the best you can. And hopefully she can, you know, if she wants to do that, that'd be a fun bonding moment for us. But they're into soccer, all three of them, at a club soccer here now. So that's where their heart is.
Absolutely. Great. And given you live with four women and you're raising these three daughters, you know, do you have any insight on raising body positive daughters, especially, you know, in the context of all the recent press surrounding women in sports?
I mean, I think it's, you know, really unfortunate. Some of the things that happened with the women's gymnastics, what happened with the project and all that stuff. And I mean, women are powerful. We should empower them. And I come from a culture, that Eritrean culture. I talked all the great things about it in terms of food, but on the women's side, that they need to be a little bit paid attention to. It just is right. And my wife makes sure that I learned that. So it's good and bad. But at the same time, you know, the more, especially when you're married, the more you can be a team, the easier life will be. So, you know, I always, for me, at least growing up, my parents made clear that we might have chores that are different, but we respect our sisters with due diligence, and they can be anybody they want to be. You know, we have anywhere from a doctor to education, master's and Stanford graduate. And we don't see in Eritrean, maybe in the back home, the women are not as, they don't have the opportunities that men have or boys have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, been a father of three, as you know, do all due respect to Kobe Bryant, who unfortunately lost a great hero, and his daughter and the many lives that were there, and he's empowering that. And I think, you know, it's very encouraging to be able to be there for your daughters. And I'm fortunate to have a strong wife who understands that and able to do that for them also. You know, I show them love and kindness and hard work. Don't cut yourself short. You can be competitive with anybody. You gotta put your mind to it and be the best you can.
Awesome. One last and totally random question. When I was, you know, in the audience of the Alley on the Run show where I met you, you were mentioning, I believe, the Obamas and having dinner with them or chatting with them. And you mentioned talking about nutrition with the Obamas. So I'm curious what kind of nutrition stuff you guys chatted about, if you're allowed to say so, that is.
Yeah, I mean, they were great people. More admiration for them and respect that I have. And I was honored to be invited to have dinner with them, with the U.S. leaders and African leaders summit. And my wife and I attended, and President Jimmy Carter was sitting there with us. And I wish I could have that photo, but yeah, I was sitting next to President Jimmy Carter. I came to my side of the table, and then President Obama came, and he hovered over us. I wish I had that picture. That's a priceless picture. And but we talked about, you know, how I won the Boston Marathon nutritionally, cross training, and the nutrition is, you know, eating the right food, because you are demanding a lot out of your body, and you have to replenish it. So we talked about from the you can to you know, 2 meals a day, and to cross training, and you know, and I was thinking about President Jimmy Carter this morning on my run, because he said he ran, I believe he said 4 days, 7 miles, in a week. So he would run 4 days a week, 7 miles. I ran my 9 mile today. I'm like, I was planning on doing 8 before I start adding another mile. I'm like, I should start doing that. You know, I would be like President Jimmy Carter. I was thinking about it. because now I'm at the point where I question how much is enough, how much is not, what am I training for now? You know, before I had in the back of my head, I was thinking about maybe the trials and things like that. But now I'm like, I know it's not going to happen. I'm like, I don't need to run 10 miles, 12 miles like I used to, but what can I do to be a healthy lifestyle? And, but yeah, so it was a great honor to be at the White House with those two great presidents and Michelle Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, and be able to chat about, you know, the nutrition and cross training, and also just the humanity. I remember asking her about their daughters, what they did that summer, and things like that. So it was pretty awesome. Cool, and just what an honor to, for as we started with your broadcast podcast, that coming from Eritrea, war torn country, to eating dirt, and then to be able to be an immigrant to Italy, and then come to the United States, and to be sitting at the White House, be invited after I won the Boston Marathon, have a, you know, when he called me, you know, he called me from his Air Force One, and I didn't know what to say. I'm like, hello, Mr. President. I'm like, well, I wanted to call you, congratulate you. I'm like, well, thank you, Mr. President. It means a lot to me, and this and that. So to having that, and he says, well, we'll be in touch. And I said, oh man, he sounds like a politician, but he did live up to his name. And so that's how the conversation started. And when I got invited to the White House, have a dinner with them.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. It's a true American story there, you know, or American dream, as they call it. Awesome. So I know you got to run soon. So let's finish up the podcast with what I call my quick bites questions. So favorite meal or snack when in a hurry?
Banana.
the best.
Easy one to peel. Can't go wrong. It's not a messy and one not.
Favorite meal or snack when you're not in a hurry?
Oh, I like probably have mango, because it takes time, it's messy, and then, you know, I like to have a tea, like sometimes tea and crackers.
Oh, nice.
I can sit and relax.
Favorite post-race meal or snack?
Oh, I gotta go with you can. I gotta have a you can there. Just, you know, after a race, the first thing that I start salivating before the workout is over or before the run is over is a shake of a chocolate flavor you can.
What do you have, like after you won Boston, what did you have after that race, like a meal? Do you remember what you ate?
I'm pretty sure, and after you can, I waited a couple hours, and then I had a big steak. I love having steak.
Yum. I was actually there, by the way. I ran 2013 and 2014 Boston, so I was there both years, but thankfully I finished, I think that it was like 35 minutes before the bomb went off in 13, but in 2014, I remember running, and it was a tough race for me, but I remember hearing you won, and it was just so uplifting. It was amazing. Oh. It was such an amazing day.
It might be the 80 pictures that I took before the bombing happened, before I left. I was there as a spectator, because I don't get those opportunities to chat with runners.
Your story is crazy.
There's photos, and it might be in there.
I think I was a block away, because I was in the family meeting area when the bombs went off, and we didn't even know what happened. So, but you were like right there a few minutes before it happened. Oh, so scary. Anyways, I don't know if you cook or ever cooked, but if you have ever cooked, biggest cooking catastrophe.
Oh man, I do. I'm learning how to cook, but I'm too detailed. When I cook, I pay attention to details. It might not taste good, but I don't burn anything up yet.
Okay, so not yet. So TBD not on yet. That one.
Yeah.
Most bizarre or exotic food that you've ever tried?
A crocodile in Sydney, Australia, at the Olympics.
Oh, did you like it?
Yeah, it's fine. It was just like chicken.
That's what I hear, right? How do you like your eggs cooked?
A scramble, well done.
What is your favorite alcoholic drink if you drink, or non-alcoholic if you don't?
I like to have, I know I did the 26.2 beer, and I don't drink that much, but when I do have dinner, I like to have wine.
Nice.
Red wine.
What foods remind you of growing up? What are your comfort foods? Maybe it's that bread you mentioned, or
it's
anything
the bread, else. Two things. I was telling when you come from a farm, you roast your, I guess my wife was saying it's like a bonfire, but you roast your corn, having a corn roasted over the fire and having eaten really neatly, not messy, just chew as much as you can, but line by line. But I also love having the fruit of a cactus. It's very delicate in Eritrea. So when I go there, I always have it. I have to have it in Eritrea, those two things, at least.
Have you been back to Eritrea recently?
I've been there 2017 with my wife and kids, and they even the dog, my middle child, is like, you gotta try this. It's so good. You gotta try this. Very sweet, very sweet. And like 2 days before we left, they said, this is really good. I'm like, oh, I've been telling you for 2 months.
Awesome. What is your favorite ice cream flavor? Since I know you love ice cream.
I love having the coffee lovers. Is my oldest sister Ruth introduced me to it, and if I'm gonna have now, I like to have that. I used to be vanilla, but coffee lovers.
And last but not least, top three items of gear that are most essential to your active lifestyle.
Well, you gotta have your beautiful and lovely comfort Skechers shoes.
Yeah.
My Maui gym sunglasses, and I have to have, it's very important to have a CEP compression socks, because as we older, as we run, we need to recover.
Well, thank you, Meb, so much for your time today. It was such a joy having you on, and such an honor, of course. And I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure my listeners did as well. So thanks for your time.
Thanks for you for the support, Claire, and great to see you again.
Awesome. Have a good one, Meb.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed my chat with Meb and hearing about all the foods that he has enjoyed throughout his life, his athletic career, and of course, now that he's in retirement and finally enjoying all the treats that his heart desires. If you have any feedback, you have any requests, questions, anything at all, please get in touch. My email is eatforendurance@gmail.com. Of course, my website, eatforendurance.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a special one for me, one that I wasn't sure was going to happen, to be honest, and I'm just so grateful that it did. Have a great one, guys, and thanks, as always, for your support.